one of the most notorious murders of the Troubles is the focus of a Netflix documentary. The Miami Showband Massacre tells the story of the murder of three band members killed by the UVF while returning from a gig in the early hours of the 31st of July 1975. I've been speaking to one of the survivors, Des Lee. He started by telling me about growing up during the start of the Troubles.
Our family were told never to get involved in politics. And I got involved in music. And my father was a musician. My father used to play in Maximus in Fountain Street in Belfast. He was the resident musician there. Apart from that, he was also fitter foreman at Shorts, the aircraft factory in Belfast. So my father had two jobs. And I idolised my dad. My dad was a brilliant musician, much better than I am or ever will be. My dad was a fantastic musician. He played with the BBC Light Orchestra, among others, and very talented in that he could play saxophone, clarinet, guitar, flute. My dad influenced me into getting into the music industry, and I got the bug. My dad worked two jobs to make sure we were all well-educated, well-fed and well-clothed, and I admire him for that enormously. But as the band went from getting gigs and recording and everything, I realised, hold on a wee second, I don't want this day job. I want to be a full-time musician.
And you were doing really well. You were packing out venues. People were coming to see you. I saw footage where people were screaming and yelling. And, you know, again, that was their escapism. And then we get to the summer of 1975. Tell me what happened towards the end of July, that month.
Well, that month we had been touring as a band extensively all over Ireland. Now, we were used to playing both north and south. We had a minibus for the personnel for travelling to gigs, and we had a minibus with the road manager, Brian Maguire. He would take our equipment to the gig, set it up for us. We'd arrive at a gig, do a sound check and go on stage. And we were actually known as the Irish Beatles, you know. So it was all glitz, glam, screaming girls. It was a great life. It was rock and roll, as they say.
And then everything changed. And you were at a gig on the 31st of July. And this was just a regular gig.
We got on the bus to go to Banbridge. We were booked that night to play in the Castle Ballroom. The gig was a fantastic gig, as usual. We then, at about 2 o'clock in the morning, it was time for us to get in the bus and travel back to Dublin. And on the way back, we had been stopped at what we thought was a legitimate checkpoint. Now, we were used to, of all our travels in Ireland at that time, we were used to checkpoints.
Yeah, so this wasn't out of the ordinary.
This was not out of the ordinary whatsoever. So we were pulled over. We were asked to get out of the van, which was not unusual either. We were asked to face the ditch, which we did. We were then asked various questions, age, date of birth, where you living, your full name, all that type of thing, the normal questions.
And did they acknowledge at that point that they knew who you were? They knew off the Miami Showband?
Correct. They had done their homework, and I'll tell you why they'd done their homework. One of them turned around and said, which one of you's Dickie Rock? Now, Dickie Rock had left the band previous to that, and we had a laugh. We thought this is all easy come, easy go. You know, we didn't think of anything bad.
Just routine.
Just routine. Yeah. And we made a joke out of it. We said, oh, no, we fired Dickie. We got rid of him, you know, in a bit of a joke with them. And so they had done their homework when they knew about Dickie Rock. And what happened then was, I asked, could I go to the van and take my saxophone out and put it on the road and show them that it's my saxophone, which I did. So I was standing in the line, and I would have been to the left of the line, closest to where the guys were that were talking to us. But I went to the van to get my saxophone out and put it on the main road. When I did that and opened it up, instead of going back to where I was in the line, which was second, third on the left, I stayed at the end of the line. Now, what I didn't know was that two of the perpetrators were putting a bomb, a 10-pound bomb, in the van. That exploded prematurely, blown me over the ditch into the field below. I then was blown into the field and I lay face down in the grass and I was playing dead. Like I remember the GI movies, the Vietnam War movies, what the GIs used to do. So I lay face down in the grass, holding my breath for as long as I could. And all I could hear around me was mayhem. There was shooting, screaming, crying. It was pandemonium.
And when that happens and that blast blows you into the field, are you aware of what's happening? Like, what are you thinking at that point?
We thought we were being attacked at that point. That's what I thought. I thought we were being attacked by someone on a hill or a road or whatever at that time.
Not by the people that had stopped you.
Yes, yes. But then I heard words coming from the people around us which convinced me otherwise. Are those bastards all dead? There was words like this coming out. You know, have you checked those bastards and all that type of comment was going on.
And could you tell at that point that was from the people that had just been talking to you on the roadside?
When I heard the accents, I knew they were Northern. Me being from Northern Ireland, I recognised the Northern accents and I knew, oh my goodness, what's happening here? And I continued to hold my breath for as long as I could.
And could you tell what had happened to the other band members, your friends?
Well, I heard the gunfire, I heard the crying, I heard the screaming. And at that stage, I didn't know exactly what had happened. What happened is when the screaming and the crying and all the noise calmed down, I called out the names of Fran, Bran and Tony and I got no response. I called out Stephen Travers and he moaned to me. And what happened was there was a ditch to the left of me. And that ditch had caught fire because the van, when it exploded, there was petrol obviously in the van. That set the ditch on fire. The ditch was coming up close to my body as I was lying in the grass.
The flames?
The flames. And I realised, if I don't get out of here, I'm going to be burnt alive. So I said to Stephen, I'm going to make a run for it. Now, if I'd had been representing Ireland in a running championship, I would have won a gold medal. Because I ran up that hill. It was just incredible how quick I ran up that. I got onto the main road. And I flagged down. There was a lorry coming along and I flagged him down. I explained to him what had happened.
Were you hurt at this point? Were you any
I had shrapnel in my legs. I had shrapnel in my legs from the explosion.
And were you aware of that? It sounds like a silly question, but I assume your adrenaline, your body is in overdrive. Were you in pain?
I was in pain. I was in pain. I was absolutely shell-shocked. I could see body parts, for example, on the road, and it was a horrendous scene that was around me. And I said to the lorry driver, will you take me into Newry Police Station? He obviously thought I was part of the gang, and he refused to take me. Our minibus had been blown to pieces. There was boots, for example, that the guys were wearing, part of our stage wear, was lying on the road as well. And there was photographs of the band and all that sort of thing. So he could see everything that was going on. And he probably thought I was part of this gang and he refused. And he had a trailer on the back. And I said, look, if you don't want me to let you in the cab, I'll get on the trailer in the back. And he refused that as well. A young couple then came along and they took me in to Newry Police Station. But as I was going in, at that stage, I trusted absolutely nobody. I had my hand on the handle of the door. And I was watching to make sure they were going into Newry. If they weren't going in towards Newry, I was ready to open that door and jump out of the car.
Yeah.
But thank God they did take me into Newry Police Station.
And what kind of conversation are you having with that young couple? Because you've just been through the most horrendous thing. You've seen body parts. What are you thinking?
Well, basically, my whole thing was the worry of what was happening with my friends, who was injured, who was dead, what exactly was going on. And I just wanted to get into the police station to get help as quickly as possible. I then got into the police station and there was a lady police officer on duty at the time, RUC. The first thing I asked the lady for was a cigarette and I'd never smoked in my life. And I ended up having a cigarette and explaining to her what happened. And I was screaming at her to get out there, get help, get the ambulances out, get the police out, get the army, get whatever out. And she was explaining to me, we cannot do that in case anybody gets ambushed. We will have to send a helicopter out to do a search. So they would send a helicopter out with floodlights to search the area and see that the area was safe for them to proceed into.
But obviously you're aware of what's just happened and that your friends, they need help. They need medical help, and correct, every minute could mean their life.
Correct. Yeah, correct.
So what happened next?
The next thing was they organised for a doctor to come and see me. And the doctor came in and gave me tablets. Now, at that stage, I trusted absolutely nobody. And I took the tablets and I put them in my sock and I drank the water he gave me. He came back later and he did exactly the same thing. And I did exactly the same thing. I put the tablets in my sock once again, drank the water. And basically, I sat in that room crying.
At this point, did you know, were you aware that three of your friends had died?
No, I didn't know how many had died. I was only aware that Stephen had been injured because he was moaning.
Yeah,
he didn't talk properly to me. He only moaned. But the fact that I got no recognition from Fran, Bran and Tony when they called their names, it did worry me. It did worry me a lot. But I was hoping also that maybe they are injured. It was only later that I found out that day that they had been murdered.
And who told you?
I was told by the RUC.
I wonder, because it's all so much to comprehend and to process. We're all human, and that's such a horrific experience to go through. Was there a point soon after where you really realised that you came so close to death?
I've got a guilt thing about the whole time. You know, I felt guilty when I heard the news that Fran, Bran and Tony had been murdered, when I heard that Stephen was seriously injured and I only got shrapnel in my knee, and I had this guilt complex that here am I, I'm alive, the lads are gone, and I felt guilty about the fact now I have to face the families.
You felt guilty for surviving?
For surviving, yeah. I felt guilty for surviving. You know, why am I alive? What gives me the right to be alive? And the lads are gone.
And does that get easier?
It does as the years go on. And I must be honest, I have discussed this with the families, with Helen McCoy and the O'Tooles and people like that. And they have assured me that they've got no problem with me whatsoever regarding that. You know, I get on very well with the families, and I have done,
of course,
all down the years.
And people will be thinking, well, of course, it's, you know, it's not your fault. You weren't responsible, and therefore you shouldn't feel guilty for not being murdered that day. But, you know, our minds just don't work that way.
Correct. Correct.
How does your life adapt after something like this? What happens soon after? Because you didn't trust the police, mm-hmm, when you were in that station. You weren't quite sure who was responsible for what had happened. Mm-hmm. So how do you then hope that justice will be done?
Well, you know, as the years went on, we were obviously fighting for justice and for the truth to come out. And we're still doing that to this day. You know, here we are 40 odd years on. We still haven't got the truth. We still haven't got answers that we've been asking for, you know, and we keep getting blocks put in our way. For example, our lawyers have been asking for certain documents down through the years to help us with our court case, which is taking place at the moment in the High Court in Belfast. And we've been having blocks put on several times and documents going missing and things like that. So it's been an uphill struggle since the day it happened in 70, and it still continues with me to this day. I'm still fighting for justice and the truth.
Just briefly talk me through what did happen soon after, because there was a court case not long after this happened back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Just remind us what happened then.
Well, what happened was we got a phone call to ask us would we be prepared to go to Belfast for the court case. Now, because we lived in the jurisdiction of the Republic of Ireland, it was outside the jurisdiction. We didn't have to go to the court case in Belfast. But I said, for Fran Brennan-Tony, I want to go because I want to see justice. Whoever it was that had this savage murder attack on my buddies, I wanted to see them get their justice. And I decided I'm going to go to the court case, but I made conditions. I was living in fear of travelling on the road and been hijacked and murdered or whatever again. And I asked for us to be taken into Belfast by helicopter. We then appeared in the courts for the court case, and it was a rather harrowing experience for me. I had never been to court in my life. And here I am facing the men who had murdered my buddies. And that was a very, very difficult situation for me. I actually lost it in the court. I started screaming. And the people in the court told me to calm down and to answer the questions that were been put to me by their lawyers. And I screamed out. I said, you know, I feel like I'm the guilty party here. And I was told, please answer the questions. And later on, their lawyer, actually, we had a break in the proceedings, and their lawyer actually came and apologised to me. He said to me, I'm only doing my job. And I said, I appreciate that, and I'm sorry about the outburst in court.
Many will be aware, but just in case they're not, it was actually the UVF that you had been stopped by on that roadside that
night.
You said that even in 2019, you feel like you are still fighting for justice. So what element of what happened to you do you believe is still unsolved, is still, there's not someone paying the price for what they did?
There's a lot of things which haven't come out. We want truth. If it's truth and reconciliation, we want justice, but we want the truth to come out. And as far as I'm concerned, there has been a lot of people hiding behind the truth and not giving us the answers that we deserve to get. There was massive collusion. For example, Jackson, who was one of the murderers who pulled the trigger, they believe, and killed Fran O'Toole, that he was an informer.
And he was one of the so-called soldiers that stopped you at the side of the road
that night.
That's
correct. That's correct.
But he was a member of the UVF.
Yes. It's proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that he was an informer, and that he possibly was involved in the Glen Ann gang. And not only was he involved in our massacre, but they also, there's reports that he was involved in the Dublin and Monaghan bombings as well. So, you know, this is a man who pulled the trigger on God knows how many people, apparently it was quite a lot. And this man was able to walk free, you know. And when I see stories like that, you know, I go back to what I said to my friends. Where they got the uniforms? Where they got the weaponry? Where they got the bomb-making equipment? It was all planned well in advance. And when I got the report to tell me who was involved, I was appalled, absolutely appalled. And today I just hope and wish, I hope we never, ever go back to those bad old days.
Why do you think that the Miami Show Band were singled out? Why were they selected for that?
We were singled out for the simple reason that we were a massive band. They wanted maximum publicity. And the Miami Show Band, they couldn't get any bigger at the time. If they were going to target a band, we were the target. And because we were all over the press, we were all over the radio, you know, we were all over television, and they picked us. These are the guys who want to get.
How do you feel? Because I can tell you're, obviously there's a huge passion for music there and for the Miami Show Band and who they were. But for a lot of people, the band is now, it's linked to that terrible tragedy and not the music.
You know, That's a very true statement. I personally live every day with this. You know, I've got photographs of the lads in my bedroom and in my lounge. So every day of my life, I live this. Every day of my life, I get people asking me about the massacre. You know, I don't mind talking about it. You know, I like to get it off my chest. But I do realise that this will haunt me until the day I die. I know that is the case. But for Fran, Bren and Tony, I just want to see justice done. I still haven't got it. But till the day I die, I want to see justice.
What's next for you? Can you ever escape it? I know people obviously want to ask you about it. They're interested in it. It's a huge part of the history of Northern Ireland and the Troubles. But do you ever want to just move on?
Yes, I try to move on. I'm a solo entertainer as well as playing with the Miami. You know, we still do gigs as the Miami. We've got a gig coming up in the Opera House in a couple of weeks. We also have the Miami Show Band Story, which is opening in the Opera House on the 8th of August, and it's going to tour all over Ireland now. That's a play that's been written by Martin Lynch and Mary Jones. I have actually seen the script, and it was very funny because Martin said, who would I like to play Des Lee?
Yes, and who did you want?
I said Brad Pitt.
What was his response to that?
He burst out laughing. And I've seen the script on the play, and I have to say it's a fantastic play. What I like about this is the fact that it carries on the name of Fran, Bren and Tony. I don't ever want them to be forgotten. And to give you an example of that, we have got a monument in Parnell Square in Dublin to the Miami. I've had meetings with the Newry Town Council from all sides of the spectrum, and they have agreed that we will install a monument in Northern Ireland to Fran, Bren and Tony.
You know, your life has been quite a journey of ups and downs. You had your wife, Brenda, was there by your side for much of that.
Yeah, my wife Brenda was the most amazing woman any man could wish for. She guided me through all the bad times that I had after the massacre. She was by my side, stood by me. She would advise me on things. Unfortunately, there were things that happened which I have failed on. For example, after the massacre, one of the things I turned to was alcohol. And I admit it now, I was probably an alcoholic. And I was ashamed of myself. And I have now given up drink. I haven't drank now in 1.5 years. I think Brenda would be pretty proud of that. I lost her in 2005. I lost her too, unfortunately, to cancer. I was living in South Africa at the time, and she said to me before she passed away, stay on for a while and see, can you settle down in South Africa, what you want to do. But I decided to come back to Ireland because my wife is buried with her mum and dad in Cork, and I wanted to be able to visit the grave more often. People, after seeing now the Netflix movie, I've watched it.
And what was your reaction? I watched it for the first time last night.
There was good points in the movie, but I just felt that the movie was condensed for a certain audience and that it didn't tell the whole story. There's lots more that should have gone in that story. They should have had more time spent with the families, their parents. There was no mention about our drummer, Ray Miller. There was no mention about our road manager, Brian McGuire. Look, there were good points in the movie.
Yeah.
The fact is that people now all over the world are able to see what went on during those terrible years in Northern Ireland.
The Miami Show Band, that documentary, is on Netflix now. Des, I could talk to you all day, but unfortunately we are out of time. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you so much. Pleasure.